This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think there's still a lot of people out there who are not making amends and that are not accepting the reality and that are not doing everything they can do to drive the change. There are companies that are simply saying, we're going to keep doing oil and gas, and that's where we're going to focus.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we figured you might need a respite from biting your nails down to the quick over the election. So today we're speaking with two Americans living overseas about their respective work to make the world a better place. First, we welcome back to the show Michael Payne, a former wind power executive and cycling advocate, to get an update on how alternative energy and self-propelled transportation are progressing in his adopted country of the Netherlands. Then we speak to Julianne Euler from Rwanda about her nonprofit, the African Entrepreneur Collective, an organization which helps support small businesses in Africa. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my good friend, Michael Payne. Michael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Good to be with you.
So you have been on the show before to discuss wind power when you were running Shell's wind division in Europe back in the day. You've also been on the show to talk about cycling when you were running the Bike Coalition for Houston. So why don't you first give us kind of a man-on-the-ground view of how alternative energy has evolved in your decade-plus living overseas?
Well, Alex, it's very exciting to see how the sector has evolved over the last 10 years. I think as you hear in the press more and more, which is good, the cost of producing energy is continuing to decline when you look at what's called the levelized cost of energy for producing kilowatt hours from either solar panels or from wind turbines, be they onshore or offshore. And that means they're more competitive with or without subsidies, and they're more frequently a preferred choice as countries look to reduce their reliance on fossil fuels.
What are some of the biggest challenges that are facing the wind industry there specifically?
Well, I think depending on which country you're looking at, the challenges can be around siting. So in countries that are more where wind has existed for a longer period of time, getting sites permitted is a challenge. In countries where wind is a newer technology, that's less of an issue in many cases. When it comes to offshore wind, you have, of course, the challenge of countries having to decide how they want to manage the resource and think about integration of projects with whatever other sort of offshore activities may be taking place, whether they're fishing or dredging for sand or tourism or otherwise. So, those challenges have always been consistent and will likely remain even as, the level of penetration goes up of the technology. So I'd say there's similar challenges there at different stages of development in different countries.
How about offshore versus onshore? How is that dynamic playing out in terms of investment?
Well, I think, globally, you continue to see more onshore development, but the growth in the offshore industry is coming on fast and at a level that we have never seen before. So, whereas 10, 15 years ago, people could only install offshore wind turbines in water that was say 15 or 20 meters deep, they're now going much deeper, and the reality of a floating foundation is evolving rather quickly, and whereas that was sort of really considered fantasy, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago. There are now a wide range of companies which are trying to launch that, which is important because that opens up many more areas of the sea for development.
How has the Trump administration's stance on wind, and specifically Trump, who loves to talk about how he knows so much about wind power, and he really doesn't, but he also, in a very dangerous way, thinks he knows a lot about it. And he some of his talking points are that it's not good for American businesses because most of the turbines are made in Germany and China and kills a lot of birds. How has his ignorance on the wind power subject affected America's ramping up of wind power and in terms of wind as a part of this country's grid?
Well, I think you know, what's clear is his reluctance to acknowledge climate change has slowed the penetration of renewables in the U.S. and it has it's hurt our country's ability to address the issue, as well as it's also given ammunition to other countries, Australia or otherwise, that may have been moving more quickly had we been going ahead with the Paris agreements at full steam. So it's, you know, the states in the U.S. have, many states have moved forward on their own without the sort of federal support that existed under the Obama regime and Obama presidency. But you know, the impact is goes beyond, you know, his rhetoric. We could have a presidency which is supporting regulation, is supporting changes to the power grid infrastructure, which facilitate more wind development. And, you know, bringing wind from, you know, the rural resource rich parts of our country to the populated urban coasts. That hasn't been happening, but hopefully will going forward. And hopefully, you know, reinitiating support in the Paris Agreement is something that we can celebrate and continue to build momentum with other countries that have been suffering from equally disruptive sort of lack of commitment that we've had in the United States.
Let's turn to cycling. So you lived in the Netherlands for several years before going back to Houston and running the Bicycle Coalition in that city. Now that you're back in the Netherlands, what are some of the biggest transformations that you've noticed in terms of bike lanes and other habits, electric bikes, et cetera, in the Netherlands? And what can we learn from that here in this country?
Yeah, so, you know, it continues to be a real pleasure to live in the Netherlands and be able to take advantage of the infrastructure here. I think there are so many things that not just the U.S., but most other countries can learn from the way the Dutch are structuring their infrastructure. The key things, I think, relate to making it easy for people to go between their home and wherever else they need to go. So in the short rides that most people do in their cars, a high percentage of the trips you make are less than 3 miles to the grocery store, in many cases to your office, and making sure there's adequate, safe parking that will protect your bike is one of the things they're doing in the Netherlands. They're building large underground bicycle parking lots that are well lit, that are secure, video cameras, security guards that make people comfortable to leave their bike there. You can park very quickly and easily and get where you need to go. Of course, the infrastructure is second to none here. So, you know, bridges over busy roads, cutting out and tunnels underneath busy roads so you don't have to stop and you don't have to wait. You just keep on riding and you can ride all around this country without having to put your foot down and stop. And that makes it a much more pleasant experience, but it also reduces the commute times dramatically and puts you on par with a car in a lot of cases as well.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train.
it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Michael Payne. So, Michael, you're one of the more dedicated environmentalists that I know, and we've known each other since college. We've had Dan Dicker on several times, who's an oil expert, and his new book is called Turning Oil Green. And one of the main themes throughout the book is that he thinks that big oil companies are maybe our best bet to make this transition to fossil fuel free energy sources, just because of the amount of infrastructure they have in place and the fact that they're looking at their bottom line, that there is money to be made in alternative energy industries. Your wife is a senior executive at Shell, and you worked at Shell for many years. Explain that dichotomy that you have and maybe your stance on the role that big oil is should and will play in the decades ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Alex, and I think it's an important one for the public to think about, because you know there's a lot of animosity against the oil and gas industry at the moment, and you know, while everyone has a responsibility to make the best decisions they can possibly make each time they spend money, both as individuals as well as corporations, I think society needs to recognize that corporations will be critical to this transition, and aligning those businesses is going to be an important part of the transition. So you know, the oil and gas industry has been solving complex problems for a long time. Like you said, they're staffed full of engineers who understand the systems, how these things happen, how energy is moved, how it's produced, and how it gets to the market. And granted, there are differences between electrons and other sorts of energy. But when you look into the future and you think, okay, hydrogen is going to be an important part of our energy infrastructure for the world, these companies are used to producing industrial gases and managing them safely and moving them through heavily developed parts of our society and our countries and cities. And they're also used to raising large amounts of money and deploying it. And I think there's an important role for companies to be playing there. Now, you know, some companies are more reluctant and are not as eager to participate in that transition. And I think that's really where the attention should be focused.
You have a real unique perspective in that you get to talk to the CEOs of some of the most powerful corporations in the world. So these are educated people, and I guess the catch-22 is that most of them know better now, but a lot of environmentalists like ourselves look back at things like ExxonMobil being so complicit in repressing information about climate change during the 80s. They have some explaining to do in the eyes of so many progressives and environmentalists. How have people who should have known better in the 80s, how are they making amends? How are they viewing things like their role, their company's role for decades in suppressing information about climate change? How are they going to make amends and make this world better with the enormous capital that they're sitting upon?
That's a good question, Alex, and I don't know the answer to it, to be perfectly honest. I you know, my sense is that there will be some people and some companies which are the last to accept and acknowledge the reality. And unfortunately, we're seeing more of those companies in the U.S. than other parts of the world, which is embarrassing as an American to you know, have to say. But I think there's still a lot of people out there who are not making amends, to use your words, and that are not accepting the reality and that are not doing everything they can do to drive the change. There are companies that are simply saying, we're going to keep doing oil and gas, and that's where we're going to focus.
I think it's unrealistic for people to expect the oil industry to just pivot on a dime. But there are profit motives for them to make changes as well, aren't there?
There are. There absolutely are. And it's critical for these companies to transition into different technologies, into different markets. And they recognize that, I think. And you see that, you know, at BP, and you see that at Shell, and you see that at Total. You see that at Equinor in Ørsted in Scandinavia, and a lot of these other companies which have historically participated just in oil and gas, moving into renewables in a variety of different ways. But, you know, the challenge is, they're large, very large corporations with very large asset bases, with long life, 40-year life assets for refineries and infrastructure. And you can't just turn around and put, huge billions and billions, deploy that in a way that generates return overnight, and certainly not if everybody else wants to do it also at the same time. So what we really need is a united approach, a united front, going across markets and across countries and driving the transition as fast as it can be implemented without creating too much pain, such that there's backlash, and that pain will be spread throughout society. I mean, corporations can't just pay the money themselves. They'll go out of business if they do that. It has to be built into their pricing model for their consumers, and ultimately the consumer pays either through their own direct purchase or through subsidies, which are, a tax-driven collection of revenue that goes through the government and then gets cycled back out to the businesses that are, providing services and organizing people with know-how to deliver new products and services. So we all pay as individuals at the end of the day.
Well, it's always a pleasure to get your insights. Michael Payne, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Julianne Euler. She is the CEO of the African Entrepreneur Collective and joins us from Rwanda. Julianne, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much.
So where exactly are you right now before you explain what the African Entrepreneur Collective is all about?
I am right now in Kigali, which is the capital of Rwanda, over here in East Africa. We are having a rainy afternoon and evening, but always nice to be here in this really beautiful and clean country.
So why don't you explain the mission of your organization, the African Entrepreneur Collective?
So African Entrepreneur Collective, sort of at the heart of what we do, it's supporting local businesses to grow so that they can improve and contribute to economic development, and also be the job creators that are so needed right now in their communities. There are a ton of smart people every year graduating from universities all across Africa, and the growth of the economy isn't keeping pace with the new entrants to the workforce. So really, there's a strong need for the creation of jobs and good jobs. And, we know from the U.S. that small businesses are really the heart of these job creation in our local communities. So at African Entrepreneur Collective, we go out and look for high potential small and medium enterprises, and we provide them with really basic business skills around financial management, around HR, marketing, and then we also provide debt capital so that these businesses can grow.
And who do you partner with to not only receive the funds, but to distribute them?
Yeah, so we have a lot of really strong partners. We've been doing this work in Rwanda since late 2012. And over the course of the last 8 years, have worked with more than 13,000 businesses across the country. And we couldn't do that without a strong network of partners. Our lead investor is an organization out of San Francisco called Kiva. They support our loans to small businesses. And then we also, the entrepreneurs themselves, they pay a small fee for service. We have tremendous partnerships with the government of Rwanda, with large donor agencies, and then also philanthropic capital from MasterCard Foundation, IKEA Foundation, and a bunch of small family foundations throughout the world.
So explain how Kiva works to our listeners. I'm fairly familiar with it, but I'd like to understand how they benefit from working with, let's say, a bundler of a collective, if you will, of entrepreneurs, because Kiva is this micro lending site and nonprofit that tries to get money to the most needy, but in a incubation type model. How does AEC fit in that puzzle?
So Kiva is a phenomenal organization with a tremendous mission to get affordable debt capital out, just as you said, to people who need it the most. And the way that they're able to do that, and the majority of their work are through field partners like AEC. And so Kiva does due diligence on us and then extends us a credit line so that we can then go and on-lend to the businesses that we think are in most need and have strong abilities to repay. So we have full discretion over the types of businesses that we lend to, and we are then able to benefit from Kiva's very, very extensive crowdfunding platform to raise awareness for our entrepreneurs and then also make sure that they're supported through Kiva's networks.
I took my love, took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around. And I saw my reflection in the snow. Covered hills till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons of my life?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Julianne Euler. She's the CEO and founder of the African Entrepreneur Collective. So, Julianne, why don't you explain the legacy of the genocide in Rwanda and how the refugee population informs your work?
So in 1994, the country of Rwanda experienced the genocide against the Tutsi. And this was something that was sort of one of many examples of persecution against this particular group. And since 1994, the country has been on a meteoric rise in terms of development, just an incredible focus by the president and the government on rebuilding with passion, rebuilding with inclusion, and getting Rwanda to a point that is such an example for countries worldwide. But one of the interesting aspects of the genocide against the Tutsi was that created a lot of Rwandan refugees, and also in previous waves of persecution. So interestingly, because of this, tragic event, that there are many people in Rwanda right now, and I would sort of venture to guess that almost everybody in the country has either been a refugee themselves, come from a family of refugees, or are one degree separated from the refugee experience. And I think that that's really at the heart of why Rwanda is so open to receiving refugees from the region going through similar things in their own home countries.
And how is the global pandemic affecting your work?
So Rwanda has handled this pandemic just with incredible precision and strong leadership. As of yesterday, there were less than 250 active cases of COVID in the country. There have been fewer than 5,000 since March. And it has just been because the government took swift, decisive, and comprehensive action to control the spread of this. Within a week of the first documented cases arriving in the country, there was a very strict lockdown, restricting movement, also mandating a national curfew, mask wearing, hygiene, hand washing stations in all of the bus terminals, and throughout the country. It's absolutely been so impressive to be here during this time because it's the country has handled this so well. That being said, the economic impact of this pandemic has been incredibly difficult for the country. You know, the country was projecting, you know, 8, 9, 10% growth this year. Now that's been adjusted down to 1.5, 2% growth. What's been interesting about working with refugees during this time, and especially in a country that has been so strict on prevention measures, refugee communities, by our assessment, haven't been hit as hard here as many other places in the world, because refugees also receive monthly living stipends from World Food Program and UNHCR. And so even in these very vulnerable communities, there has been sort of a consistent and predictable monthly cash flow. And then businesses can very easily plan around, you know, this population that hasn't lost their sort of monthly income in the way some other districts or villages have.
So how can people support your organization, Julian?
We're always looking for great people to join us in this mission. To learn more, our website is the best place to go, and that's www.AfricanEntrepreneurCollective.org. And then also we are active on social media, on Facebook and also on Twitter.
Julian Euler, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Nickel Creek, Cat Stevens, and Fleetwood Mac. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.